Hello, comrades, and welcome back to Marxist Voice, the podcast of the Communist. For this week's second episode, we're going to have another talk from last year's Revolution Festival, this time around on the Iranian Revolution of 1979. For a lot of people, the Iranian Revolution is associated with the creation of the Islamic Republic, which is still around today, and the rule of the reactionary Ayatollahs. But in fact, the Iranian Revolution was one of the most inspiring revolutionary episodes of the post-war period. Without much in the way of a pre-adopted plan or a program, the Iranian masses rose up against the hated regime of the Shah. The masses seized power for themselves through the factory and neighborhood councils, and even began to plan parts of the economy for a brief period of time. However, without a conscious Marxist leadership, coupled with the betrayals of the Stalinist Tudeh party, the revolution was unable to consolidate its power and began to enter into decline, resulting in the counter-revolutionary seizure of power by the reactionary Islamist clergy. So in this episode of Marxist Voice, Hamid Alizadeh, who is a writer and activist for the International Marxist Tendency, will explain these events in great detail and draw out the lessons for today. With all that said, we hope you enjoy this episode of Marxist Voice, brought to you by The Communist.
Thomas Carlyle was a biographer of Oliver Cromwell, the English revolutionary. He wrote that before he could write that biography, he had to dig out Cromwell from underneath a mountain of dead dogs. And I think that kind of also applies to the Iranian revolution, because there's so many myths and distortions. There's like a whole industry, essentially, of distortions and lies about what that revolution was really about. What we're told is that this was an Islamic revolution. It was against modernization, against democratization, against westernization, that the Shah, and you know, the Shah basically means king in Persian, that the Shah wanted to introduce. And it was a conservative Iranian masses who were opposed to this, and therefore they went into this medieval, essentially, direction. But obviously the reality is completely different, because what we witnessed in 1979 was an enormously deep popular revolution, with millions and millions of workers, peasants, and poor entering the stage of politics and taking without any leadership, without any plans, without any program, without any party, actually taking power in their own hands and holding it at least for a split second before losing again. And that's the story that this industry of lies does not want to come out, essentially. Well, capitalism came to Iran actually quite late. Really, capitalist development started happening in 1908, after they discovered oil. And at that point, it was Britain in particular that started investing. It showed an interest in Iran. Oil was very important, as today, I guess, element for the British Empire. And the delay in the development of Iranian capitalism meant that Iran was, well, throughout its early history, capitalist history, was dominated by bigger imperialist powers. And up to World War II, that main power was Britain. You had the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which is essentially British Petroleum today, which controlled all of the oil exploration and all the oil installations in Iran. 99% of all the profit, essentially all of the surplus that was created in Iran from the oil, was just immediately channeled out of the country and into the hands of the British. But after World War II, you saw the beginnings of a changing situation. You saw rising movements, popular movements, mass movements developing. And you saw the rise of a guy called Mossadegh, who was a liberal prime minister at that point of Iran. Mossadegh was a bourgeois liberal, he was a capitalist. He wanted to develop Iran along capitalist lines. He wanted to modernize Iran, develop it. Which then led him in 1951 to pass a law for the nationalization of the oil. And this received an enormous support from the popular masses. Such that the Shah, who tried to depose him, actually, according to the law, the Shah had more power than the prime minister. Prime Minister was just a rubber stamp kind of a thing. But they couldn't, because as soon as they went for him, millions of people poured into the streets and they had to back off. Britain reacted very violently against this. They immediately implemented an economic blockade of the whole country and entirely refused any negotiations with Mossadegh. Mossadegh was actually quite amenable to the demands of the bourgeois. He said, well, we can just share the profit 50-50. But the British would not have anything less than everything, essentially. And therefore they went into opposition. And what you saw was the beginnings of a kind of an anti-colonial liberation struggle, essentially, taking place in Iran. The Shah, as I said, was completely powerless. The power of the masses was too powerful. And it became essentially moved towards a revolutionary situation. And what essentially happened, and we're not going to go into the actual developments here, but what happened was that in 1953, the CIA orchestrated a coup to bring down Mossadegh and to crush this movement and to cement and to consolidate the rule of the Shah, which after this point became an American puppet. And Iran went from being a British semi-colony to becoming an American domain. Now, Iran from that point on became a very important part of the of US imperialism and its designs in that region. It had the Americans built up Iran with the most powerful army in the region, and it was strategically placed just south of the Soviet Union and east of the Middle East, and therefore played a role in both directions. And in order to protect this regime, they spared no funds and no resources, essentially. You know, today they talk about the Shah regime as this kind of liberal paradise where, you know, women were free and everything was free. But that is completely opposite to what was actually taking place. It's true that you didn't have a mandated scarf. That's true. Although the Shah's dad did actually forbid people from wearing scarves, and there were laws and discrimination against Muslim people back then. But I guess you didn't have to wear a scarf. But that was more or less the only difference fundamentally with the regime that we have today. The regime, the Shah's regime, cracked down on any type of opposition violently. And in order to do this, in order to essentially preserve this regime, the CIA built what was called the Sabak, which was the intelligence agency, extremely brutal and notorious intelligence agency, shaped in many ways on the kind of general guidelines and trends taken from the Nazis. Some of the things that they would do in their interrogations, I mean, they had the helmet, for instance, which would magnify your screams tenfold. So the more it hurt, the more you would hurt from your own screams, essentially. They had mattresses with red hot, what do you call it? Feathers.
Springs.
And then you would have to lie on and sleep on. They would have red hot needles that they would stick into your eyes and your throat and your nose. This was just a little, snapshot of the nice democratic and liberal thing that the Shah's regime would give to the Iranian masses. And in the meantime, the Shah also tried to modernize Iran. Iran was a relatively economically backward country at the end of World War II. And so he implemented what's called the White Revolution, which is supposed to be like a bourgeois revolution implemented from the top. There was a land reform, for instance. There were different reforms. Essentially, what it led to was a consolidation of power, of economic and state power in the hands of an even smaller minority that had it before. You had a land reform, for instance, which bankrupted millions of peasants and farmers. Everyone except the absolute top landlords paid a heavy price for this. And so you saw hundreds of thousands of bankrupted peasants going into the cities, living in these tin cities out of, tin areas outside of the outskirts of the cities. And even the middle layer landlords were entirely bankrupt, always close to it. And you had also in terms of the clergy was an important lever of power for the Iranian ruling class throughout its history. You had tens of thousands of mosques, and they had an important power base. But the Shah wanted to kind of push them aside in order to, you know, not to having to deal with that headache, essentially. And as he did this, he expropriated huge amounts of mosque lands, essentially, mosque property. And again, in that way, pushed the clergy, which was an important part of the middle class, into opposition. And one of the people, the person who was maybe alienated the most, was Ayatollah Khomeini, who was one cleric, who was basically pushed into exile. He went to Iraq. And Khomeini was kind of a... he was a bit nuts, to be honest. He was a bit mad. But what happened was that because he didn't have anything to lose anymore, he didn't have any links to the top layers of the ruling class in Iran, he didn't have links to, you know, the top echelons. He could say anything. And he would speak very, very radical speech, give extremely radical speeches, which were then taped and distributed amongst the clergy. And although he was, you know, initially that only reached a relatively small conservative layer, but that was to play an important role in the future. And especially he got a following amongst the lower levels of the clergy. The clergy in Iran is a big social layer or caste, you can say. The top layers are entirely
connected to the aristocracy, to the capitalists, and so on. The bottom layers are extremely poor. They're part of the poor masses, often even poorer than working class people, you know, just living from hand to mouth or whatever the village kind of. The poorer the community, essentially, the poorer the imams and the clerics, and especially amongst the poorest layers, Khomeini got a certain influence. And also another thing the Shah did was that you had the bazaars. The bazaars, the kind of commercial centers of trade in the Iranian towns and cities, And they obviously also had their own power base in relation to the Shah. And what he tried to do was to establish his own kind of distribution networks which went around them. So instead of having, you know, these bazaars, he would sit and trade, I don't know, send 10 tons of steel to some other city. This is a lot of what's going on in bazaars. It's not just, you know, fruit and jewelry being sold. He would create his own distribution channels, supermarket chains, and so on. Yes, partially as a means to modernize, but also in doing so, pushing, undermining these layers of the middle classes and pushing them into opposition. Essentially, layer after layer was pushed into opposition as power, economic and state political power was concentrated in the hands of a tiny minority at the top. Now, at the same time, you had a world economic boom taking place in the post-war period, and that affected Iran. A lot. The oil income exploded in Iran. You went from, was it in 1954, 55, you had $34 million oil profits in all of Iran. And in 1975, i.e. 20 years later, you had $20 billion. Obviously, that's a lot for today's money. So that led to a huge economic boom. It led to a massive industrialization. As a part of that industrialization, you also saw the rise of a mass industrial working class, a powerful mass industrial working class of fresh workers or first generation workers. They had no illusions, no traditions. They just came straight from the villages, essentially, into some factory, into some oil refinery. And they were educated in the school of capitalist industry, essentially. And in this whole process, the entire demographic of the country changed. You saw mass urbanization. The urban population went from 20 to 50% of the population within one generation. That's a huge shift taking place. And all of these things essentially increased the relative weight of the Iranian proletariat and the urban population. But obviously this development was extremely uneven. This economic boom did not benefit everyone, far from it. And essentially you had 1,000 individuals who owned 85% of all private companies. And obviously the majority of companies were not even private. They were in state hand. They were owned by one individual, which was the Shah. And meanwhile, as I said, you had these massive kind of slums in the outskirts of the cities, where most people didn't have water, electricity, access to healthcare, schools, hospitals, nothing of that kind. The workers did not have stability. Jobs were quite precarious, as we might know it from today. And meanwhile, you had the royal family who lived in an absurd kind of parallel universe of riches. You had in 1971, they had the 2,500th birthday of Iran. You can say anniversary of the Iranian monarchy. And this was a party that cost them $120 million, so it's like $1 billion today. For many years, it held the world Guinness record for the longest and most extravagant dinner in modern history. I don't know how they kind of measured those things, but it was insane. You had 50,000 songbirds imported from some African country. They all died within a few days because they couldn't live in that climate. All of the best restaurants in the world, all of them were shut down for 2 weeks. Their whole staff of chefs and waiters and so on were shipped, from Paris, New York, everywhere, London. They were shipped to Iran to make food for all of these people, hoteliers, sommeliers, anything you could find of obscene wealth and riches and extravagance was concentrated there. And all of the world leaders, by the way, also came to honor this. Great royal family, although actually the Shah's dad was the first generation of his dynasty to take power, and there was nothing royal in his blood anyway, but let's not talk about that. And meanwhile, you had hunger, literally, extreme destitution in the slums, in the cities, everyone struggling to survive. And then you had on top of this, the 1974 world economic crisis, which exacerbated all of these contradictions tenfold. You had massive inflation. Officially, it was 20, 30, 40%, but in reality, it was especially for poor people, it was a lot more than that. And so you can see the buildup of what leading to this revolution. At the same time, there was another process taking place in the US, because in 1976, you had the election of Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter's strategy towards the Soviet Union was slightly different. Instead of going the nuclear war rhetoric path, he decided, no, actually, it'd be smarter to go down the human rights path. So, we talk about human rights and democracy. That in that way, you can gain an ear inside the Soviet Union. You can start to, create trouble behind enemy lines, so to say. And of course, having like a brand of human rights was not very, did not suit very well when your closest ally, you can see that today, for instance, with the Americans and the Israelis, when your closest ally is this brutal, murderous, openly barbaric and, backward regime. So this created a certain tension with the Iranian Shah, who was in fact quite offended, and, he thought that he was being left behind like a little brat, so to say. But he still reflected some of this, and he did pull back a certain level of the repression that was taking place. And there's an old French historian, Alex de Tocqueville, who once said that the most dangerous time in the history of a regime is when it tries to shift its weight from one foot to another, i.e. if it goes from repression to a more open state, or from more open state to a more repressive kind of regime, because it opens up the floodgates for the masses to enter the stage of history. And we saw this process in Iran as well. You saw mass student protests, neighborhood protests, village protests, strikes starting taking place. And at the end of, in October 1977, you had this thing, it was a poetry reading, essentially. It was a big thing because you hadn't been allowed to do such things. It was a big open poetry reading. And in Iran, poetry is a big thing. Everyone, that's what people are about, essentially, for a large part of the time. And a lot of these poets, the majority were left-wing, definitely in opposition to the king. A lot of them were left-wing, communists, and so on. And you could see that this became a real focal point. And they tried to shut it down, they tried to repress it, but the cat was, so to say, out of the bag. And what you saw initially was the students, the middle class layers, the intellectuals, the most sensitive barometers that something was going on deeper in in society coming to onto the scene. But you saw immediately after them the process starting developing and going deeper into society, so to say. You saw increasing protests and street fights. The regime tried to crack down, but what would often happen is that people would die. And in Shia Islam, you have a tradition of mourning, where you mourn after the 3rd, the 7th, and the 40th. You essentially have a 40-day mourning period. And each one of these, because you didn't have ordinary, venues to you know, vent your frustration, the funerals became protest marches. And at each protest march, the regime would kill more people, and then the funeral of those people would then become... And you had like a whole wave of snowballing protest movements developing all over Iran until the summer of 1978, where the Shah basically switched over and said, this is enough of Carter's open policy and so on. We need to crack down. They implemented a martial law, but that only kind of instigated the movement even more. And here you had the bazaars, the markets, and the mosques becoming the only national kind of areas of organization. These were the only, there weren't any political parties of any kind of important size. And here you had groups that were in opposition who had a national network of communication. They had certain structures and leaderships. And so they filled out the vacuum of lacking organization in that movement. And meanwhile, within US imperialism, you saw the beginnings of serious divisions, especially in the State Department. And it's interesting that the Iranian Revolution, you can say, started in the American State Department, because that shows the kind of the role that Iran had vis-a-vis the US at that point. Because on the one hand, you had this guy called Sergei Brzezinski, so some people might know him, who was like a very prominent US strategist. And his line was, just give the Shah any support he needs. Just let's drown this whole thing in blood. We need to show them that we're standing by them. You can imagine some people in the US saying this with Israel today. We need to just crush this movement, drown it in blood, and we need to show this Shah that we're supporting him. Especially also to send a signal to our other allies that we will stand behind them. The Carter wing was saying, well, look, this is not looking good for us. You know, we're trying to prepare ourselves as a human rights kind of force, a democracy and all of that. And also, if we crack down, we're just gonna encourage the movement even more. And the others say, no, if we don't crack down, we're gonna encourage the movement. And you see, that's the whole point, because actually both of them were right and both of them were wrong. Because all revolutions essentially start from this point. There's a division at the top. The ruling class, which in this occasion, to a large degree, was the American ruling class, cannot rule the way they used to. And they swing between giving concessions and repression. And every time they do either one, it's already too little and too late. So you had the Shah vacillating between hard and soft methods. And as I said, in September 1978, he implemented a martial law. And the following month, there was a crackdown. There was a thing called the Black Friday, essentially, where they killed 100 protesters and wounded hundreds more. There was a state of emergency called. But this set everything exploding, essentially. They could not keep back the movement. And what you saw was an enormous wave of political strikes developing in every industry in Iran. And what's interesting here is that there were no unions in Iran. You know, sometimes you hear on the left, oh, we can't have a revolution because there are no unions. And people need to be educated in unionism first. And then after that, everyone has to be a revolutionary communist. And then we can talk about taking power. But in Iran, there were no parties, there were no unions. There was no experience in this generation of workers of how to lead a strike at all. What happened was that the workers realized we cannot take this 1 minute longer. They went into struggle, and through their struggle, they learned very, very fast. You had railway workers striking. shipyard workers, miners, postal workers, etc. Essentially, all the commanding heights of the Iranian economy, at its head, the oil workers, the oil refinery workers, who are actually the best paid and most privileged part of the Iranian working class. The regime was not stupid. This was their key kind of the key part of the Iranian economy, and they weren't going to, you know, let these workers be too bad. They basically wanted to maintain some social stability. And that was a lot of people on the left at that point were saying, the Iranian oil workers are bought off, they're privileged, and they will never rebel. But actually, here you saw the exact opposite happening. The oil workers going right at the head of the movement and leading it. And what you saw was a 90-day general strike, an enormous general strike, as I said, without any prior organization or planning. And I don't know if any one of you guys have been involved in the strikes or witnessed a strike, but one day of strike is very difficult, is extremely difficult, mentally, physically, in every way. These guys had 90 days of strikes fighting against one of the most vicious dictatorships supported by, 100% supported by US imperialism. They had all of the resources at their disposal. No leadership whatsoever, no plan. And nevertheless, they managed to break the back of this regime. This is what it is, especially the strike in the oil sector, which hit the Iranian economy right at its heart. This showed the enormous power of the Iranian working class. But nevertheless, in spite of this very, very inspiring episode, they did not maintain power. They did not take power in their hands, and they did not keep whatever power they had. And that opened the door for the counter-revolution to reorganize and plot to strike back. In the West, there was absolute panic because the fear was that Iran was going to swing in the direction of the Soviet Union. This was a key country which could go socialist. That was actually on the cards. And they realized that the Shah was a wrong horse to bet on. He couldn't stabilize the situation any longer. And so they threw their weight behind Khomeini, who they saw as a bulwark against socialism, who they saw as a guarantee that whatever happens is not going to go towards a socialist revolution. They moved Khomeini from Iraq to France. They gave him a massive platform. He was interviewed by the BBC, by all the biggest, by France, the major French TV channels. His voice memos, his messages were distributed in all of the media of the world, and they made sure that his message got in, basically. And the fact that Khomeini, for all of these years, had been so radical and from a bourgeois perspective, irresponsible, actually meant that he suddenly connected with the mood that was developing. He was the only one who seemed uncompromising to say, everyone has to go and we have to change everything. This is no good, and so on and so forth. The West realized this, but at that point there wasn't like a major disagreement between him and the West. But they could see how they used the Islamists in Afghanistan, where they supported the rise of the Taliban was essentially it started at that point. In Egypt, you had the Muslim Brotherhood, who they used against the Nasser regime. In Saudi Arabia, you had all of these Wahhabi jihad, aspiring jihadis essentially were being cultivated to go out in the world and stop communism, because they were seen as guarantees that they wouldn't bend to the pressure of moving to the left, which a lot of bourgeois tendencies actually did. Whenever you had an honest bourgeois movement or leadership, they would actually be under the pressure to go to the left and even in some cases, like in Syria, abolish capitalism altogether. So the West threw their weight behind Khomeini, and he promised them that he wouldn't touch Western interest. That was absolutely clear from the beginning. And so they joined forces to orchestrate a transfer of power, a peaceful transfer of power and to let Khomeini fill the vacuum of the leadership of the movement. But when Khomeini came to Iran, he was greeted by millions and millions of people. Some people say 8 million came to greet him at the airport. A huge, huge movement. And from the first moment, it was clear that there was no way that he could control this movement, that he could just harness it and steer it down the paths that were agreed, even if he wanted to. I think, in fact, he was probably, and a lot of the people at the top layers of the clergy were themselves swept along by the sheer power that the revolution was moving with. And within 10 days, what you had was a real uprising, essentially. Masses storming the barracks, the soldiers going over to the side of the people, people arming themselves, and the Shah regime completely crumbled. And the idea of controlling the movement and just have like a change of faces in the regime, which was the original idea, maintain the army, maintain the straight state structures, but just call it something else and have some different people. That idea was completely stillborn. Because everywhere the spontaneous movement was organizing and just making advances. In fact, here, the lack of an organization, the lack of a reformist Stalinist organization was actually a good thing, because the masses weren't hindered by that kind of bureaucracy. And they swept the regime aside. There were neighborhood committees that sprung up in the shanty towns. You had committees that took over the organization of life. Peasants, hundreds of thousands of peasants taking over land, setting up peasants, Soviets. And most importantly, in the factories, you had the development of shoras. A shora essentially just means a council, or the same word as a Soviet. And you had the rise of the shoras, which were the old strike committees from the general strike, who gradually, feeling their own power, being confident in their own powers, the workers essentially gradually started taking over more and more of the economy. They would demand the opening of the books. What's going on? What are the factories' money being and resources being spent on? If they weren't paying their wages, they would just go into the bank account and pull out and pay out their wages. Or if someone was being fired, they would say, no, you're not going to fire these guys. So, and gradually they took over more and more of the running of the economy. I mean, I say gradually, but this is we're talking weeks here and days. If the capitalist was trying to withdraw the money and run away, they would stop it. And they would take over the bank accounts. And essentially, the Iranian working class overnight took over the running of the economy. They took over, they expropriated the economy, essentially. And the capitalist class fled. They left the country, the old capitalist class, the big ones at least. And it was a huge shift in the situation. I remember when I was a child, I was born after the revolution was defeated. But I remember you still had lots of elements of this. And I remember we had some friends who were a collective of disabled artists. And disabled people in Iran were treated, as you can imagine, not very well. And I mean, neither before nor after the revolution. They took over this huge mansion. I remember this massive mansion with lots of rooms and a big swimming pool. It's like some aristocrat who owned it. They just took it over. And this is what happened. You had everywhere. Palaces, mansions, as I said, factories, shops, malls, and so on, just taken over by ordinary people. And especially, as I said, the economy. Nationalization became, a huge slogan everywhere. But in reality, it was kind of after the fact. The workers actually just expropriated the bourgeois themselves. And then afterwards, they found out, this is called a nationalization, this is an expropriation. They didn't have really, word for private property everywhere came under attack. Private property was something like frowned upon. Just talking about it, defending it, this is not something you should do. People would attack you, not physically, but like and maybe even physically if you're really serious about it. And yes, all the factories, mines, banks. I think someone told me that they were marching down. I don't know if this is true, but they were marching down some mass protest. And someone stuck their head out of a bank and says, the banks should be nationalized. Everyone just said, the banks should be nationalized. And then that was it. It was nationalized. All of the banks were nationalized. And at the same time, you had a huge explosion on the groups of the left, of groups on the left. Before this, you didn't really have mass workers' parties. There was a certain tradition. But there weren't any major groups. One of the groups that exploded was the Fadayin Khalq, who were like a Maoist guerrilla organization. They had around 100 members before the revolution, and they did terrorist attacks and so on. But they were the most known organization. They had a certain national presence, and they participated in the uprising, in the storming of the barracks and so on. Within a year after the revolution, they had at least 200,000 members and 2 million followers, or what they call sympathizers, that they could mobilize in one way or another. And you had dozens of small communist parties of 10, 20, 30,000, you know, sects of 10, 20, 30,000 people. On the first May Day in 1979, the left organized, I can't remember, it's 500,000 or 1 million people on their march, but essentially as much as the right wing did. And that showed, and the right wing had the whole of the state apparatus, they had all of the media, they were well organized, you know, they had the bazaars, the mosques that they would use to mobilize through, and so on. The left didn't have any of that, and in spite of that, within a few months, they had equal amounts of people that they could mobilize. And even the liberals, you know, Mossadegh's organization, the National Front, was a liberal organization. They talked about workers' control and nationalization. All of this was the mood and the power of this popular revolution. And Khomeini himself was powerless to do anything about this head on. And he also took on the rhetoric of the revolution. But he always gave it like an Islamic twist. And that Islamic twist was nothing to do with religion. It diluted the class contradictions which were being presented. So instead of shuras, you had the Islamic shuras, right? Different. Everything became an Islamic something, and that just meant the bosses somehow got way back in, and the masses of poor and workers were essentially not welcome. You had also the Tude Party, which was the kind of the Communist Party, which was relatively small. It had, I think, at the height, around 20,000 members in Iran. But it had a huge tradition. They used to have 5 million members in the 50s. They were very, very well known. And regardless of their size, they had enormous political influence. In effect, the vast majority of all other political parties took their theoretical foundation in the Tudeh Party's line, including the Fedayeen and so on. And their main theory was that what we're dealing with is a democratic revolution, i.e. the development of capitalism, that's on the order of the day. Iran is a backward, non-capitalist society. We need to develop capitalism so that at some point in the future we can have socialism. And in doing so, what we need to do is to support the progressive bourgeoisie, the good capitalists, the nice, smiley capitalists who actually want to develop society. And of course, that is absolutely wrong, because there is no progressive bourgeoisie at this stage. We'll talk about that later. But essentially what it meant was that they accepted the petty bourgeois leadership of this movement. They accepted Khomeini and all of the guys around him, who were the top echelons of the clergy. Before that, they had been very close to the Shah, except for Khomeini. The others had been relatively close to the regime for generations. And their disagreements with the Shah was just a matter of a division of power. It had nothing, there was nothing fundamental about that. So they threw their weight behind Khomeini. Now, in a country like Iran, the petty bourgeoisie the middle class is a big layer, and it has an important role to play. You cannot ignore it. You can't say, no, we're just a workers' party, it's just a workers' revolution, and we don't want to, that's a non-starter. But the point is to understand that the petty bourgeoisie has different layers. You have the top layers, as I said, who are closer to the ruling class. You have the lower layers who live alongside the workers and the poor masses. But through their class interests, they are, and the class position in society, they're unable to lead a revolutionary movement. They don't have the solutions, essentially. However, it's the task of the working class to win them over, i.e. the task of the communists and the working class in a country, in a revolution like the Iranian revolution, is to break the middle class along class lines, so to say, break away the poor middle class layers and lead them and rally them behind the workers' revolution, which means you need to have a socialist working class program to start with. But Tudeh did it the other way around. Tudeh rallied the working class behind the petty bourgeoisie and adopted the petty bourgeoisie's program and slightly adjusted it to be kind of more a left wing. And they supported, Khomeini is anti-imperialist, he's a democrat, he wants to develop the Iranian economy, industrialize Iran, modernize it, and so on and so forth. But Khomeini did not have any of those kind of illusions. He represented a class interest which was clearly directly in conflict with the interests of the working class. And he saw and the whole layer immediately saw the shuras, the councils, as a threat to their position. And the more powerful, the more confident the working class became, the more it was clear this clash of interest that existed between the top echelons of the movement and the workers. You had, and this conflict came out pretty much from the beginning. You know, you had loads of workers saying, look, we gave you all of this power, we can take it back again. And you don't represent us, and say, where are you taking this revolution? But these voices never got an organized expression. They never got a leadership and an organized expression. They could have taken power, in effect. As I said, on May Day, they organized huge rallies. Most important parts of society, the working class had the dominant leading role, but it didn't have a party to take on that role. On the contrary, they clung on to Khomeini harder and harder, to support this bourgeois, this progressive bourgeoisie that was going to solve everything. Despite this, Khomeini could not move against the revolution head on. He had to take on the clothes of the revolution. He had to call himself an anti-imperialist. He had to call on, you know, speak on behalf of the oppressed. He had to talk about nationalizations, although only in order to use them as a means to save Iranian capitalism. And what really changed, one of the big changes in the situation was the hostage crisis. I don't know if you heard about the 1979 hostage crisis. At this time, Khomeini was trying to maintain good relations with the Americans, but his own base, his own conservative base, were moving increasingly against the Americans. They tried to storm the American embassy once. Khomeini kind of stopped them, and then they did it again. And he realized that I can't. If I go against the movement, I'm just going to be swept aside. So he went along with it. He called himself an anti-imperialist and started raging against U.S. imperialism, the British, and so on. And what happened was Tudeh and the leaders of the left who followed the Tudeh used this as a means to say, look, he is an anti-imperialist, he is a progressive, we need to support him. And on this basis, they supported Khomeini in cracking down one movement after another. In Khuzestan, in the Arab-speaking countries, there were uprisings. In the Kurdish-speaking area, there were uprisings. In the north, you had landless peasants who expropriated, you know, huge amounts of land. And they came into conflict with the new regime. And at every point, the Tudeh and the other leaders of the left would say, look, we're under threat by the imperialists. We need to unite. If we divide, the imperialists are going to win. And therefore, we're going to support the regime in cracking down on the movement, which gradually then became more and more tired. And the most resolute and most advanced layers were destroyed. In September 1980, then, supported by the West, Iraq launched a war, an invasion of Iran. And Khomeini used this, again, as a means to consolidate his power, consolidate a new state apparatus, in essence. He called the war a gift from heaven, because it allowed him, again, to crack down, to rally the nation behind him and crack down on any sort of opposition with the full support of the Tudeh. And gradually, the shuras were shut down, the neighborhood committees were defanged or shut down. One after another, left-wing parties became illegalized and cracked down on. Thousands of people were arrested. The Tudeh stuck by Khomeini right until the end, until the Tudeh party itself was also banned. And you had tens of thousands of people essentially going to prison. And a few years later, in 1988, thousands of them killed, executed, and that was the end of the Iranian revolution. This was a fantastic chapter, you can say, of the class struggle, of the Iranian revolution, of the history of Iran. And it took many, many years for the working class to recover this enormous blow that was up. In some ways, it hasn't even, although I think it's starting to move again. But we're not here to say, oh, what a shame they had a revolution and they lost. We're here to learn the lessons of that revolution. And I would say there are four main lessons. One, this should give us an incredible trust in the creative power of the working class and the masses, who, as I said, they had no leadership, no parties, no theories, very low cultural level. You know, these were, a lot of them couldn't read or write. They just, one generation before, they lived in the villages. Maybe some of them, some of the workers themselves came from a village where they had no school or any cultural kind of institution to speak of. They hadn't read the Communist Manifesto. They hadn't read any of our programs. And regardless, they organized and they broke the back of one of the most powerful regimes of the world, supported by the most powerful imperialist power the world has ever known. And not only that, they managed to take power in their own hands. They nationalized the whole of the economy, took it in their own hands, as I said, and came to the same conclusions as the Marxists, but through their own experiences. And that should give us trust and confidence in our ideas. This is what happens in all revolutions. And once the working class begins to move, it moves towards socialism. The second lesson, I would say, is the idea of a progressive bourgeoisie, that there's somehow some part of the capitalist class who are better than the others, who can, you know, who can show a way out, who have more human face, and who can develop society in any way, shape, or form. We see that capitalism, the problem is not the people or their intentions. They can be as, you know, great people as they want. The problem is that within this system, there is no longer any room for improvement. And the only class that has an actual interest in developing society is the workers and the poor. And insofar as you see sometimes capitalists giving concessions to the masses, it's on the basis of pressure from beneath, because they're afraid of losing everything to the workers if they don't give those concessions. And every step forward in the Iranian Revolution for the working class gave it such confidence and belief and understanding of its own power and position in society that the capitalists could not reconcile with the working class. There was no way they could do that. Even if they could have survived and managed economically, politically, they needed to crush the working class, because it wouldn't have stopped at just the bourgeois democratic revolution. Once it understood its own power and position, it would have continued all the way. Thirdly, I would say the power of ideas. And here we're dealing with a negative example, because look at this enormous potential. You know, this was a laboratory example of a leaderless revolution. It was the best case a revolution you can possibly imagine. It moved in the direction of socialism, and yet it failed. And why was that? Because of a lack of a leadership. And because of a lack of, and because the leaders that were there, the organizations that were there, had a wrong, approach, had wrong theories, essentially. Well, they didn't have a theory. And what happened was, essentially, you saw two camps in the Iranian Revolution. One camp was a majority camp of the Tudeh, the Stalinists, who were following the line of the Soviet Union, who were saying, we're looking at this enormous movement of all sorts of different classes, and accepting all of it, essentially, bowing to it, pushing the working class underneath it and behind it. And on the other hand, you had, which I haven't talked about, but you had the more terrorist, ultra-left organizations who could see, yes, we need socialism, but who then went on and just denounced the movement as a whole or attacked it and thereby distanced itself from it. Whereas the Marxist approach is, first of all, for an independent class position of the working class, an independent program of the working class, with the aim of breaking all of the other layers in society and bringing the most progressive, the most revolutionary elements of it behind the working class. And lastly, as I said, this was a laboratory example of a leaderless revolution. And of course, there are no guarantees. We cannot say that the working class can never take power without a leadership. It is definitely possible. But you could not have better conditions than here. And you see the amount of obstacles that the bourgeoisie and the counter-revolution would put up in the face of the working class. Many of them they overcame through trial and error. But because they weren't prepared, they weren't organized, they didn't have the necessary understanding of the logic, the rhythm, the laws of a revolutionary situation, and what needed to be done to bring it to its final conclusion, they were defeated. And that tells us something about why we need to prepare a revolutionary leadership today, when the same process is now starting again, and we're going to see similar developments in one country after another, and we need to be ready. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for listening to Marxist Voice. We hope you enjoyed the episode. But before you go, just a few quick announcements. As always, if you agree with the ideas and perspectives that I put across on this podcast, then it sounds like you're a communist. So why not get organized? Marxist Voice is more than just a podcast. It is the podcast of the Revolutionary Communist Party, which is the British section of the Revolutionary Communist International. Across the world, we are trying to organize revolutionary workers and young people in the fight against capitalism. What sets us apart is that we take extremely seriously the study of the lessons of Marxist theory and of revolutionary history and applying those lessons to today. Capitalism has never been in a deeper crisis than it is today, and the working class has never had so much potential power than it does today. It's our job as communists to turn that potential into a real material force, and that begins with building the Revolutionary Party. So if you agree, then you need to get organized with us. If you head to the show notes of this podcast, you'll find a link to our application form. If you fill that in, a member of the party will be in touch with you as soon as possible, and you can begin your journey as a revolutionary class fighter. And if you're not quite ready to join yet, then there are other ways that you can support our work. First of all, you can take out a subscription to our newspaper, The Communist, as well as our theoretical magazine, In Defense of Marxism. The latest issue of In Defense of Marxism contains a wealth of articles centered around the question of the African Revolution and the struggle against colonialism. So if you'd like to take out a subscription, head to the link in the show notes of this podcast. And finally, you can donate to the party as well. Whether you'd like to set up a one-off donation or a regular donation, any contribution that you make will go a long way in providing a strong material foundation for the forces of communism. Mass revolutionary struggles, like the Iranian Revolution, are on the order of the day around the world. The key question is, will a mass communist party be organized in time for these struggles taking place? The success of any revolutionary movement hinges precisely upon this question. And this is something that you can contribute towards today. So, with that in mind, we hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of Marxist Voice, and make sure you stay subscribed for future episodes covering Marxist theory, revolutionary history, current events, and party building, brought to you by the Revolutionary Communist Party. See you next week.